You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 27th of March to the 2nd of April 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter David Matthews, deputy news editor John Morgan, editor John Gill and news editor Simon Baker. HEFCE has published its 2014-15 recurrent grants and student number controls data, revealing which universities did not meet their places quota for the current academic year. More on that in a second. Are academics trading light workloads for better teaching evaluation scores from their students? A study in the US claims this could explain why student evaluation of teaching scores in the US are on the up while teaching hours are falling. David Matthews has a remarkable story of a Dutch head of a university in Papua New Guinea. He's currently in exile after being deported. More on that in a second. Our cover feature sees five academics recalling their PhD supervisors, some great, some not so great. And earlier I spoke to Matthew Rice about an academic with a liking for surfing in war zones and other no-go areas. But first, John Morgan, HEFCE data out shed some light on university student recruitment. What's the story?
So what these figures from HEFCE reveal is that universities that proved less popular with undergraduates this year have had their student number allocations for next year cut, and this is despite the fact that there are 30,000 extra places being made available by the government. So what the figures essentially show for the first time is which universities didn't meet their places quota in 2013-14 and correspondingly had their allocations for next year cut. So
which are they? I mean,
it seems to be principally big post-1992 universities like Kingston, UEL, Liverpool Hope, Staffordshire, who've fallen short, and they've all had their undergraduate allocations cut by about 3% for next year, which indicates that they fell short by that amount on their student number controls this year, because HEFCE has made the allocations for next year on the basis of demand for this year. But to complicate things in the way that the system is very complicated these days, it's only non-ABB places that are subject to student number controls. For ABB students, universities can recruit as many as they like. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't met your student number control for non-ABB students, for some universities that might be deliberate. They might have chosen to kind of raise their reputation by not recruiting non-ABB students, and that may be a conscious choice. So given it was complicated by the fact that these figures are issued under a no approach embargo, so it made it impossible to check with the institutions that were falling short exactly why they fell short. Was it deliberate, or was it the fact that they just weren't able to get the students in?
Mm-hmm. One of the things this story hammers home for me is how extraordinarily complicated this whole situation is. I mean, full respect to you, John, for actually getting to the bottom of what's going on and explaining it quite clearly, because it really is. I mean, I think you were saying the other day, Simon, it'll be a relief when the new system comes in, and all these extraordinary twists and turns that have been, this sort of system that's been built piecemeal over the last few years, is just sort of wiped away and
layer
much more straightforward.
Layer of complexity.
Yeah, you wonder how anybody ever hits any targets, or you know, maybe they don't. It's amazing.
Mm. No, it's an interesting story. And the post-92 larger institutions were sort of showing up as struggling, yeah, in particular. I mean, what does that tell us? Is it more, you know, sort of...
I think the perception when the new system started was that some of the former polytechnics, the larger former polytechnics, without kind of the perception of prestige, would find it harder to recruit students under the new system, and there might be kind of other post-1992 institutions that are kind of that have been more proactive and have transitioned to the new regime better, and they're pulling in the extra students, and some are left behind, really struggling for students. So that does fit with the general picture, but it could also be the case that these post-1992 universities are raising their entry tariffs, and they don't mind if they take a bit of a drop in student numbers because they're going for kind of the increase in reputation.
I'm sure we'll find out once we're allowed to approach the institutions and actually ask them about it. Page 6 and 7 for that story this week. Over the other side of the Atlantic, Simon, we have a story this week on the SETs, so Student Evaluation of Teaching, a study alleging that teachers are going easy on students in exchange for positive reports on their own ability. Is that about the size of it?
Well, yeah, I found this pretty fascinating story. I mean, you say it's on the other side of the Atlantic, but it kind of has a direct comparator in this country, in the NSS, basically. Yeah. So... and the NSS is constantly kind of criticised by academics in this country as not really being a very robust survey, and doesn't really indicate whether students are happy with particular courses or not. And what this piece of research, academic research, in the States shows is that there may be not kind of explicit collusion between academics and students, but... sort of tacitly, that they both have an incentive for a lighter sort of workload and for easy to give easy grades. Basically, because if lecturers go easy on their students, they get a good grade and a lighter workload, they're more likely to rate them highly when it comes to a student satisfaction survey. And the other byproduct for academics is that, you know, they're having to mark less. Then they've got more time for research as well, the one thing that actually does bring in more money for their institution. So you can see if all the incentives are wrong, then you've got something that influences the satisfaction survey in this way and doesn't really do a service for students either.
No. They're drawing a direct link, aren't they, between the number of teaching hours falling over the last 40 or 50 years and the student satisfaction scores rising. I mean, it's interesting that when NSS started out here, we had that spate of explicit, you know, call it cheating if you like, where people were actually sort of caught red-handed saying to students things like, you know, you must, it's in your interest to give us a decent score because you're the one that's going to come out the other end with a degree that's judged, the quality of which is judged on the NSS score. So, you know, the sort of threat that you wouldn't necessarily go on and get that good job if people thought this university wasn't a high-performing institution. You had that very explicit... quite cack-handed attempt to influence the NSS, but this is suggesting that in America at least it's moved onto a much more subtle, as you say, a sort of pact between teacher and student.
Yeah, disengagement pact is the phrase they use. I mean, I think it would just ring true of a lot of academics in this country as well. It just seems, you can see that the psychology of it does make, you know, a lot of sense, really.
And I mean, kind of the root of this, you could argue, is that actually how hard it is to get a degree is not measured. So you can keep reducing these standards, and yet student satisfaction is measured. And so you can, you know, cut the workloads. No one will actually pick up on that. But you do actually need to hit these kind of NSS or student satisfaction targets.
I mean, it all boils down really to the big elephant in the room of comparability of degrees, really.
Exactly.
Because there is no independent way of assessing, you know, how hard each degree is, how difficult it is to get certain marks, and there's just no, and this is a problem that's been highlighted in UK higher education for years, but nothing is ever really done about it because it's very difficult to measure teaching really and the outcomes of teaching. I mean, there's lots of problems with it, but that's what it all boils down to, really, I think.
Yeah, we have another story this week as well on the NSS, which I wrote. A group of students at Manchester University, the Post-Crash Economic Society, wanting to change the curriculum at Manchester to reflect some alternative views on economics, particularly following the 2008 financial crash. And they're sort of saying to their fans on their Facebook page, don't fill in the NSS until we get a ruling on whether the university is going to listen to our suggestions for a change of curriculum. And if they do, you know, feedback positively. If they don't, then maybe you should consider that in giving your when giving your feedback. So almost holding them to ransom would be one way of looking at that.
I mean,
I guess.
That sort of leverage again. I mean, that's the NSS is designed in such a way that it does give student that leverage, and they're using it very explicitly there. But I mean, this is It's really interesting to think that there could be a very widespread, I mean, at the very least, there's sort of the opportunity for a very widespread use of that leverage on both sides that could be to the detriment of both university and student, I suppose.
Yeah. I really don't know how much it's kind of deliberate. It really does boil down to a lot of the time that, you know, if you're a student and you're getting a good, you know, good feedback from your tutor and good marks, then you're going to feel good about your course, aren't you? Whether you've actually kind of learnt anything or worked hard to get there, might be a different matter entirely.
Yeah, well, indeed. One academic struggling to give any feedback to his students or indeed his staff is Albert Scram, I believe it's pronounced. Is that right, David? You've been speaking to this academic with a remarkable story.
Yeah, this is... I can't remember writing anything this bizarre in the THE before. This is probably the strangest thing I can remember writing. So it's a long story, but Albert Schramm, he's Dutch and he had quite an international career. But in February 2012, he was appointed vice chancellor at UNITEC, which is one of the big two public institutions in Papua New Guinea, which for those who don't know is a part of an island just north of Australia.
When you say the big two, how many are there?
There's just two. And so. He spoke to me from Australia, where he's been sort of exiled from the university and from the country since the beginning of last year. I mean, he's had enough challenges when he took up his post to begin with. I mean, it's a very impoverished country, but you know the things he was facing on campus was sort of 10 to 15 power cuts a day, so the internet didn't work. Support staff basically having to live in slums on low wages, and actually sort of tribal fights on campus, you know, sort of groups of students divided along tribal lines. And before he got there, a student actually died in a kind of big battle between these two groups. And yeah, he basically says that there's massive underinvestment in universities in the country. I mean, if this wasn't enough, he returned from Singapore on a business trip in early 2013, and was told that he didn't have leave to enter the country, and he was promptly deported to Australia. And he's sort of been there ever since. He was able to revisit the university very briefly in April last year, but ever since he's not had a visa. He's not been given any official reason for why he's been deported. But basically, it seems as though it seems from what he's said and what we've been able to find out that he sort of stirred up a bit of a hornet's nest in this university, where he says he exposed kind of fraud and corruption in how they are spending their money, and this has led to him, you know, basically the government deporting him essentially.
That's the allegation.
I mean, I'll make it clear that we couldn't actually get a comment from the Ministry of Higher Education in Papua New Guinea. So this is his tale. And he's been fighting to come back ever since. And there have been kind of big protests, and you can see a big picture of one of the protests in the magazine from these students demanding him back.
He clearly has a lot of support out there.
He does. It's this big... I mean, I think the kind of university council, he's been continuing to be paid as vice-chancellor, he says, and the university council says he's vice-chancellor. He's still listed as vice-chancellor on the website. But the previous higher education minister, David Arore, claimed he was a threat to national security because he was inciting students to protest. Well, he was in Australia and they were protesting in favour of him. And, I mean, there's a new higher education minister now. The students have been on campus protesting for a while. The government's now threatened to end this academic term and declare a sort of state of emergency on campus to force students to return to class. I mean, it's a real mess.
It's a great story, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
Take yourself out of the world of rab charges and so on.
Exactly.
It's just extraordinary.
Indeed, yeah, well, we'll not give too much more away. That's page 22 and page 23. Let's bring us back to something perhaps a little bit closer to home, certainly geographically. John, Gil, this week the cover feature is all about PhD supervisors. It's a topic we touch on a lot in the THE. This week we've got five academics talking about their own advisors. from excellent to abysmal. Why this topic, and why is it such a thrust of our editorial?
It's close to home. One thing I would say in terms of the exoticism, very exotic illustrations, which I would urge everyone to have a look at. They're great fun. But what we've done this week with, I mean, we've had huge amounts of interest in the series of stories we've had over the last 6 months about PhD supervision. You know, a lot of, or well, most people that go into academia, the route in for them is PhD, so people have been through it. The majority of academics who are involved in research will have PhD students of their own as well. And it's a huge part of the system, you know, developing the academics of the future. So it's one of those areas that's really, really important nationally, also absolutely fundamentally important to the individuals. And what we tried to do here was draw out five sort of personal stories, really, about the relationship that people had in their sort of formative years early on in their career with their PhD supervisors, and the way that that's shaped them as academics or not, and strengths and weaknesses that their supervisors had. And, you know, they really do range from the good, the bad, to the hilarious. We've got tales of, you know, and not to give too much away, fire extinguishers being thrown, people who say that the main thing their PhD supervisor taught them to do was swear. We've got, you know, people who are incredibly cutting in their sort of, in their cutting harshness of their treatment of PhD students, and other people who develop lifelong friendships, you know, really nurtured and sparked very impressive academic careers. And also, you reading through these pieces, you get a sense for the patronage that's still involved in building an academic career, and the extent to which being a sort of protege to a senior established academic who has networks and is able to help you build your career is vitally important, perhaps more so in some disciplines than others. But really, this is an attempt to tell the personal stories and draw out some of the issues involved through those sort of anecdotal pieces. So it's great fun as well as touching on lots of important issues.
Very good. Before we move on, I should point out we have a second podcast this week which sees Karen Shook, our books editor, in conversation with Richard Evans, Regius Professor of Modern History and President of Wolfson College, Cambridge. Sir Richard Evans, I should say. So do make sure you check that out. However, to end this week's podcast, earlier I spoke to Matthew Rice, who's not able to join us at the moment, about the second feature this week, which forms part of our Outer Limits series. So, Matthew, you visited Falmouth University and came back having met a senior lecturer with a passion for surfing, which is not hugely surprising given Falmouth's location in Cornwall, but why does Sam Bleakley's story qualify for our series of Outer Limits features, which typically tell the story of academics taking part in extreme research projects?
Yes, well, Sam Bleakley is a very enthusiastic surfer who won various European championships. And over the years, he's gone to more and more faraway places in the tropics and so on, including places which had just emerged from civil wars and so on, places where you had to negotiate with the local fishermen to ensure that you didn't go down a road which was still covered with landmines and so on. So he's become very interested in visiting these places, which are obviously rather fascinating to visit, and the surfing is good. But he's also become very interested in the way that surfing businesses are very sustainable, they're very good for the local economy. So it creates a kind of tourist industry, which is rather unusual. And he's teaching this MA in cultural tourism management, and action sports are one of the core areas he's going to be looking at, which he's investigated himself.
Mm. So he went to Liberia post-Civil War, for example. He went to Haiti post the earthquake. Did you get an impression that his first passion was finding out about what these places are like immediately following events such as that, or was it the surfing that was taking him there first and foremost?
Well, I think he goes for the surfing, but I think he's sort of fascinated by these places, but he also says that, you know, a lot of these places have a very bad reputation or a very stereotypical idea. I mean, people talk about Haiti in terms of voodoo and violence and so on. And actually, you know, he's not, he goes with a team of people and they're not, you know, suicidal. So they get that a lot of these places where, you know, if you read news reports, are still terribly dangerous, but actually they were very much welcomed by the local community, took part in events, and found it very exciting, and that this is something you can build on for tourism and other leisure activities.
Yeah, students on that BA in tourism management are certainly going to get plenty of value out of this particular lecturer. Yeah, a bit closer to home, he also mentioned he and his fellow surfers could have predicted the severe weather in the UK that we've had this year, if only anyone had thought to ask him about it.
Yes, well, his view is that surfing is not just fun, but actually, if you're a surfer, you get to learn about the coastline, understand how the weather works. You're almost obliged to find out about these things, which are actually very useful as well.
No, indeed. Well, it's a fascinating read this week. That's all for this week's issue review. If you want to comment on that feature or indeed any of the other stories we've mentioned in this podcast, you can do so via any of the usual channels, timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Google+. Do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.